The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, I was just looking at the paper this morning, the Durango Herald, our little local paper, and I just commented to my wife how excited I was that good friends of ours, one in particular that I'm thinking of, who's a top realtor in our area, is actually making a pretty good income this last year. Home sales were up. It was a 7-year high. Now, it's been a bad 7 years, but finally, he's really coming out of what I would consider one of the toughest real estate slumps that we've ever experienced.
Well, and certainly in our lifetime experienced. If you roll the clock back, there are periods of increase and there are periods of decline, and you find that there's two variables that drive the real estate market, demographics. And if you have a demographic boom, then yes, real estate booms. To the degree that you have a demographic bust, you really have a headwind for growth in real estate. The other element, other than demographics, is interest rates. And if interest rates are expensive, just imagine a seesaw. The higher the interest rates on one side of the seesaw, guess what's on the other end? The price of homes. So when you get low rates, then you've got the seesaw tilting the other direction with very high home values. And I think that's why interest rates and interest rate trends factor in so heavily into our views, both not only the bond market, obviously, because that's the other side of the equation for bonds, but also for real estate. Because again, the cost of financing a purchase, very few people purchase a home with cash. The majority are purchasing with the help of the bank, and so the interest cost is very intriguing, very considerable. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but you know, just as a punctuation mark here in our conversation, for every 1% increase in interest rates, you're talking about losing almost 11% in terms of affordability for a home.
That's an amazing statistic. Now, you know, just like in cooking a dish, okay, sometimes you don't know what the secret ingredients are. And interest rates, a lot of people don't really realize that the secret ingredient doesn't lie within our own borders. The secret ingredient actually is coming from the emerging markets. It's coming from Asia. It's coming from people who are willing to still buy our artificially low interest rate bonds. If those start rising in price, or if we start losing those people as clients for whatever reason, then we could have a problem with real estate again, couldn't we?
Well, that's right. So for you and me, when we look at our balance sheet and say, okay, we own this home and either we own it free of debt or we have debt on it, we are concerned about its direction because we care about whether our balance sheet is growing or not. Did we lose money on the home purchase? Are we making money on that home purchase? And maybe it's not something you price in real time, but every year or two, 3-4 years, you check in and say, well, what are home prices doing in my area? And it, you know, what most people don't know is that your area is not necessarily determinant of real estate values. And you know, again, work with me here, because I think what is happening in China today is of absolutely critical importance to a U.S. homeowner.
Right.
This is what's happening right now as we transition towards the Chinese New Year. It's called the Year of the Horse this next year. And unfortunately, we're moving into a phase where investors could be getting kicked by the horse on the very first day of the year. You've got China Credit Trust Company, which has warned investors, and this is in Forbes magazine, China Credit Trust Company warned investors that they may not be repaid when one of its wealth management products matures on January 31st. Again, that's the first day of the Year of the Horse. And I think what it's important to know is that this is one of thousands, if not tens of thousands, of WMPs, what are known as wealth management products, right, which have been used as vehicles to take investor capital and basically fund a lot of development and infrastructure projects off of the balance sheets.
Well, and this is a country that's been growing 7 or 8% a year, and yet they're still saying, wait a second, we're not going to be able to pay you when it matures. So could we have a Lehman moment brewing in China right now?
Well, and that's really what we're talking about, is something that happened very similar to what was developing in the 2003, 4, 5, 6, and 7 time frame here in the United States, what we came to know as the shadow banking system,
right,
where you could look at the banks and say, how much leverage do they have? But it wouldn't give you a very or a completely accurate picture of how much leverage was in the financial system, because those same financial firms had developed financial products through, you know, again, what they would call financial engineering. Mm-hmm. Structured finance is a subset within a major bank, and they put together products which then they can sell to individuals or to institutions, and it allows for even more borrowing or leverage to be associated with that financial institution. It gears their earnings much higher, and it gives the misperception that they actually have some real balance between equity and debt, when in fact they may have far more in terms of liabilities and debt in the equation, and that's in fact what those structured products try to obscure or cover over.
Well, lest we forget, I remember when Bear Stearns came out, and they had $400 million worth of what we now call toxic debt to offer to the market. Well, the market didn't want it. It was one of those little bitty, 400 million bucks is nothing compared to the trillions we've now tried to spend to get out of this crisis. But that was sort of the thing that it was the shot heard around the world, really, Dave. When that debt wouldn't sell, it became apparent. And all the other debt through Lehman Brothers and AIG, it was a problem at the time that couldn't be fixed.
Well, so what we have in Asia is, and particularly China, is sort of the yin and the yang. On the one hand, this last year had emerging market weakness. So you're talking about a lot of your developing countries who did very poorly. If you look at the U.S. stock market versus a lot of the emerging market stock markets, stark contrast. We did well, they did not. Then you have the emerging market currencies, which for 2013, they went through a meat grinder last year, as did the emerging market bonds.
Interest rates rose.
There is an exception here. And if it's difficult to sort of wrap your mind around the world of economics and finance, I appreciate what your frustration may be, because guess what? You've got mixed communications and mixed messages coming. You know, listen, we just mentioned the fact that we could have a Lehman moment in China here within the next week or two. On the other hand, we have last year, which is a classic example of what the Chinese are putting in place as a long-term strategic advantage. Specifically, the Chinese bond market was very stable this last year, what is known as the dim sum bonds, which trade in Hong Kong, and are really the first foray for the Chinese government to issue the equivalent of what we have as treasury bills, bonds, and notes. They're just, you know, that's what they call them, is dim sum bonds. The Chinese currency, it was very stable last year. So when you compare your emerging market brethren, and clearly maybe you can make the case that it's no longer an emerging market, they are developed, but they did very well. We did not. Our bond market didn't, even here in the United States. And the emerging market bonds were terrible, along with their currencies. So they stood out as a beacon of light and a port in the storm in 2013. Now, again, the mixed messages, yin and yang in this equation. Is China doing well? Are they forging a path towards displacing the U.S. in terms of global economic leadership? Or do they face critical elements which could take them, not back to the Stone Age, but certainly put them on their heels and in a defensive position focused just on domestic issues as a result of all of the shenanigans that have been played in their banking system and, frankly, in their shadow banking system, completely unregulated?
Well, and a country will act a lot like an animal. Even George Washington talked about this. And a country that is in danger will do whatever it takes to get itself out of danger before it starts looking abroad. And, you know, what we're talking about, how does the cost of a bowl of rice in China or the cost of interest rates in China, how does that affect what we're talking about in the Durango Herald this morning about home sales? Well, it affects it dramatically because the Chinese are the ones who are allowing us to artificially keep our interest rates low. And quantitative easing, these emerging markets are buying a lot of that debt. And if they can't, like you said, if they get defensive, then at that point, who are we going to sell our debt to?
Right. And thus, what happens to our interest rates? Now, mortgage rates last year, at this time, we had just witnessed 50-year lows in mortgage rates. The national average came in at about 3.32%. And Robert Campbell of the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter, for those of you particularly in Southern California, but perhaps across the country, great resource. His focus is mainly on Southern California, but again, the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter is worth taking a look at if you have interest in Southern California real estate. He was pointing out that for each 1% rise in mortgage rates, it impacts the buyer's purchasing power, as I mentioned earlier, by 10.75%.
It's like the cost of the house goes up 10.75% as far as affordability.
As far as affordability is concerned, because that interest rate variable is so important. And he goes on to say that, given last year's 13.6% rise in housing, that is just pricing of a house, coupled with the move higher in rates, again, from 3.32% to about 4.5%, it's no surprise that the National Association of Realtors, their affordability index, dropped to a five-year low
So, David, we're looking at an improvement in prices, but we were looking at improvement in prices before the crash, and it was becoming unaffordable, real estate at that time. You're saying that this is starting to step up again?
Yeah, and so, I mean, there's good and bad here. We are 23.7% off of the cycle lows in real estate. So if you pick the lowest point that real estate got, looking at the Case-Shiller index, now we're 23, almost 24% off of those lows. We are still, for perspective, about 20% below the 2006 peak valuations for that Case-Shiller 20-city index. So where do we go from here? Yeah, 2014 is likely, in our opinion, to be a good year for U.S. real estate. You've got the Fed, which has reiterated its choice of favored assets. What is that specifically? Mortgage-backed securities. Real estate is fully supported by the Fed via its purchases of mortgage-backed securities.
Isn't it almost all of them? I mean, it's been over 90% for years now.
Right. So, I mean, they basically are the real estate market. They've played their hand and said, this is important. This is what we consider as the driving force of economic growth, home ownership, and that's likely to continue. Even if the Fed does reduce its treasury purchases, also known as the taper. So the catch-22 is that while the Fed's buying mortgage-backed securities, and that helps in many regards, it certainly helps the flow of capital into the real estate market, it also helps liquefy market operators, financial institutions. You know, it's allowing for financial products related to housing to flow seamlessly through the system. But here's the catch. By not supporting the Treasury market as much, again, the taper and reduction of $10, maybe $20 billion.
Interest rates start to rise.
Yeah, you're ultimately pressuring mortgage rates higher, even if you are buying mortgages.
Right.
And don't forget how mortgages are priced. It's relative to the 10-year Treasury. So, you know, as goes the Treasury market, so goes the cost to borrow for a home purchase. Do you care about the cost of borrowing as it relates to a home purchase? Absolutely. If you're a first-time home purchaser or if you're a refinance candidate, yes, this matters to you very greatly. But what we're saying is that you have to care about more than just U.S. monetary policy. You have to care about what's happening overseas because guess what? One of our primary purchasers of U.S. treasuries and one of the means by which we've maintained low interest rates is this relationship with the Chinese, is this relationship with the Japanese, and their willingness to buy our treasuries. To the degree that they are fixated, focused, distracted by homegrown issues, I mean, we certainly hope things don't escalate in terms of their local or regional tensions between those two countries. That would be a game changer.
Sure. Well, speaking of local and regional, I mean, one of the things about talking to clients over the last almost three decades about real estate is you can rarely generalize because regions do different things at different times. Some regions are growing. Some people are listening to this right now going, you know what, it may be picking up in Durango, Colorado, but it ain't picking up here. Then you listen to people in Phoenix or Vegas or wherever where they had a huge slump. Now they're getting a huge boom. So how's the regional side of things looking? Is everyone growing? Is everyone, where are we at?
Now, if you broke it into four regions, you know, sort of west, midwest, south, northeast, you know, real estate growth rates began to decelerate. They began to slow in November of this last year. And, okay, it may be reasonable to assume that you get slower sales in the winter months, but this is not just a seasonal month-on-month declines in growth. This is slower growth rates comparing year-on-year numbers as well. So you know, growth rates are growth rates. I'm not arguing. You know, we are talking about, this is almost like talking about Chinese growth. Right? 7.7% is great. It's not 10%. It's not 11%. It's not what it was, but we're not complaining about growth. We're still seeing growth in the real estate market. But I would say this, you've got the one of the lead guys who runs the Case-Shiller Index, David Blitzer, who's said here recently the housing market is living on borrowed time. And so, I mean, you got to take that into consideration. Things are improving. Things aren't as good as they were. There's a pickup in sales. There's segments where sales are better than others. Mid-tier housing is moving. It can be financed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and that's really what you're talking about, is if it's a conventional loan related to the house, guess what? It's going to go. Why? Because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, via the Treasury market and via the Fed, if you're connecting all those dots, if supported, you're going to get financing. It's very easy to get financing. When you move into a jumbo purchase or jumbo loan, you better be bringing a lot of cash to the table. Otherwise, it's much more difficult to finance.
Well, I think what I'm hearing you say is right now things seem to be okay in real estate. Don't mistake this for another real estate boom like we saw a decade ago. But if a person is thinking about either buying more real estate or possibly lightening up and unloading, it seems that you may be saying, don't load up on real estate right now, and if you want to lighten up, this is a good year to do it.
Yeah, well, again, we think that momentum will hold prices together this year, 2014. But anyone wishing to downsize or sell property, they should prioritize that this year. Mm. And, you know, this just is a market adage. You sell into strength.
Right.
You know, we've had a number of years of weakness. We think that there's structural headwinds, which still have to be dealt with before we have real sustainable growth in the real estate sector. So what you have here is a gift via the Fed. Tons of money printing has gone to subsidize growth over the last couple of years, and the recovery that you see is built on the backs of Fed financing. That is not our view of a healthy market. That's not our view of what ultimately would be in the category of organic growth. Here's some interesting points, though. Why should home values hold together this year? You have a reduction in foreclosure filings. You have a reduction in repossessions from banks. You have an increase in building permits. I mean, there's a number of things which say, okay, well, listen, we've picked up some momentum. The momentum will carry a certain distance. But as you dig into, particularly those building permit numbers, I think this is very interesting. It tells us a number of things which are important to keep in mind. Again, so if you own real estate, this is going to be important to you. Single-family home permits have increased 100% from 2009, the lows in 2009. We were at about 90,000, now we're about 180,000. For perspective, that's still below your 2004 to 2008 average of over 400,000. Building permits, but we're off the floor. We're off the floor, and in fact, 100% better. But more interesting is the 225% increase in multifamily dwelling permits. You know, that's up from 400,000 units to 1.3 million, and we're nearly back to pre-crisis levels.
Okay, so David, what you're saying is on single-family homes, the permits have increased. It's substantial. It's not quite back up to what it was when the boom was hitting. But as far as multifamily or multifamily dwelling permits, this is more the person who's buying rental properties. We're almost back to pre-crisis levels.
Or who's building rental properties with the intention of renting them out. Yeah, one of the fallouts of the crisis was the loss of equity and balance sheet sort of catastrophe experienced by many people who bought homes and maybe shouldn't have, or perhaps they just had unfortunate timing. Hmm. They're back to being renters, and thus you have an increased demand for multifamily dwellings, not individual single homes. You see the difference.
Right. The renters are back. Well, you've even pointed out in the last few shows, the rent is really getting high. It seems to be where the speculation is with these large firms that are buying up thousands of rental properties at a time.
Yeah, the Census Bureau ran their numbers. The Census Bureau says rents increased by 4.4%. The Fed says, well, 4.4 is your number. We come up with about 2 and change, and that's how they factor, you know, owner equivalent rent into our inflation numbers. So you've got the Census Bureau who, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is not adding up their numbers correctly. We would say, actually, it's the Bureau of Labor Statistics that doesn't know how to add, but I guess that's another story and a similar or familiar rant. So with renters back on the scene, vacancy rates are low, and in fact, they're at about a 12-year low. Renters are back. Housing demand is biased towards multifamily dwellings, and then that's not squeezing multifamilies into one dwelling. That's, you know, your duplexes, your fourplexes, your apartment complexes, etc., where you have multifamilies, many families under one large roof. That tells us a lot. 2 times as many apartments have been built since 2009 compared to single-family homes. If you want to argue for a housing recovery, you should consider that point very carefully. Yes, excess inventory has been removed, and as you mentioned, a lot of that's hedge funds coming in and buying blocks of foreclosed homes. That's helpful, but do you also have shadow inventory still held with banks where properties have not been put on the foreclosure market, and that has boosted prices. There's no question. So not being a naysayer, glad to see home prices recovered. Bought a house myself in 2009. Glad to see that home prices have recovered since those depressed lows, but the numbers indicate a far greater demand for rentals. Ownership relative to demographic growth is not a pretty picture. And so this is really the key issue. Home ownership rates are at the lowest at this last year, going back to 1995. So home ownership is not improving, even though real estate is supposed to be improving. Does that strike you as odd?
Well, and you know, something else strikes me as odd. We're going to go back to those hidden ingredients in the whole mix of real estate still rising. I'm going to go over, actually, Dave, to the excuse that's used by central bankers around the world so that they can continue to keep interest rates low and print money and quantitatively ease and, you know, buy up mortgages. And, you know, I think of Christine Lagarde right now, and she's talking about the ogre of deflation. You talked a couple of weeks ago about how in a strong society where technology is actually increasing our access to things and our transportation of things, we should have deflation. Things should be getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper because it's getting more efficient to get it to us. Yet central bankers continue to make us fear the very thing that we should be experiencing, and that is deflation, a good form of deflation.
Well, and so we do have sort of the conflict between the doves, those who would like to see more accommodation by the Fed and the world central bankers, including Janet Yellen, and the hawks, those who are, you know, concerned about inflation and the unintended consequences of money printing. And, it, you know, so I wonder what will be sort of Yellen's parting shots. You and I were just talking about this the other day, Ben Bernanke reflecting on quantitative easing, and he says, well, the problem with quantitative easing is that it works in practice, but it doesn't work in theory.
Right. He's trying to get a laugh out of it, but it's sort of arrogant that he said that.
Right. Yeah. Well, and what else did he say about quantitative easing? Most studies have found that quantitative easing is at least somewhat effective.
Now, this is $4 trillion into this thing. It's somewhat effective.
Right. And then he says, well, the Fed did the right thing, I hope. And you know, I do wonder what Yellen says at the end of her term, but you've got one of my favorite Fed officials at the Dallas Fed, who's now saying, listen, we've got to do something and do something fast. If we don't reduce this massive money printing, we are going to so foul future growth in America. And he says, you know, for those of you unfamiliar with the term beer goggles, the Urban Dictionary defines it as the effect that alcohol has in rendering a person who one would ordinarily regard as unattractive as alluring. Things often look better when one is under the influence of free-flowing liquidity.
Right.
This is one reason why William McChesney Martin, the longest-serving Fed chairman in our institution's 100-year history, famously said that the Fed's job is to take away the punch bowl just as the party gets going. So there is growing contention within the Fed. Guys, you're priming the pump for inflation, and you've got to be careful here. If you haven't already done it, we're going to end up with an inflationary problem. On the other side of the equation, as you mentioned, Christine Lagarde says, no. What we're still facing is the ogre of deflation. And you look at this in sort of a yin and yang balance. What different currents of information do we have that imply we should be concerned about inflation on the one hand or deflation on the other, or maybe stagflation, some combination of the two with stagnant wage growth and increasing prices, which may be more of the case when all is said and done. But there's a few indicators that I think, you know, we look at and we wanted to share with our listeners. The Canadian dollar and the Aussie dollar. Canadian dollar and the Australian dollar, as it were. These, for us, are leading indicators of a re-emergent deflationary trend. Why is that? These are countries that sell lots of stuff. We're talking about iron ore, we're talking about lumber, we're talking about just stuff, and that stuff gets used in building of other stuff. So, you know, right now we've got a hiccup in China. They're not importing as much as they were, and lo and behold, we have major layoffs. In fact, one of the worst years for layoffs in Australia, going back to, I think, 1992. And you see it reflected in weakness in the Australian dollar. The Australian dollar has been weak this year. The Canadian dollar has been weak this year. And the final confirmation of a radically slowing global economic picture would be for copper to break below $3 a pound. And that's, as you know, many people call copper the commodity with a PhD in economics. And it has yet to confirm these declines in the Canadian dollar and the Australian dollar. But it's something that I think our listeners should definitely pay attention to. The loonie is what they call the Canadian dollar. It began to deteriorate in earnest from its trading actually above parity to the U.S. dollar. It was in more than a one-to-one relationship. It was more expensive, you could say, of greater value than the U.S. dollar just a few months ago. It's now trading 10% lower from its 2013 levels.
David, you're going to have to explain to me, with the value of the Canadian dollar decreasing, how is that? I don't understand fully how that's actually tying into a deflationary trend. What does that mean?
Well, we're really talking about three canaries in a coal mine. And if you want an indicator of a, you know, again, there's too much debt in the system. We already know there's too much debt in the system. And we know that the world central banks have done one thing to solve the debt problem. They've thrown more debt at it. So that ultimately does imply that we're right back where we were in 2007, 2008, at the beginning of the crisis, because nothing structurally has changed. We haven't solved the problem. All we've tried to do is paper over it.
Right.
What you should look at in terms of a leading indicator of getting to the point where you just can't keep up with the debt anymore, things that imply what is happening in real economic terms.
So, David, what you're saying is the countries that produce stuff are just not selling stuff. Yeah, we've created trillions of dollars, and various countries have been trying to paper over this, but the demand for their stuff, and in this particular case, like with the Canadian dollar, the demand even for their currency, it's declining. We're not in a recovery. That's the bottom line.
Well, precisely. And so what we've been witness to, not only in the stock market here in the U.S. this last year, is really the results of brilliant financial engineering. The problem is brilliant financial engineering does not substitute for free trade and transactions occurring between not only people but between countries. So all this is to say you've got the global economy, you know, when the global economy is growing, demand for raw materials increases.
Right.
Commodity producing countries, they're the beneficiaries of this, both in terms of the volumes of exports and in terms of currency appreciation. What we're seeing is not an indication of growth, but the opposite. Central bank infusions of capital, they've boosted demand to a small degree, but they have yet to jumpstart organic growth. So, you know, what we're watching now is these three canaries in the coal mine. You've got your Canadian dollar, which, again, they export tons of raw materials. They're not exporting as much as they were.
Right.
And it's having an impact not only on their economy, but their currency. So the Canadian dollar, the fact that it is slipping now and is at a technical level of support at 90, yeah, this is very important to us. If it breaks these levels of support, we go back to where the Canadian dollar was trading circa 2008 and 2009.
Then you brought up the Australian.
Yep. And again, they had their worst layoffs this last year since 1992.
Right.
And its currency is reflecting weakness. And you know what's going to happen. They're going to compound the weakness in the currency by the Australian Central Bank saying, hey, wait a minute, we can't afford to have a slowdown in the economy. We don't care if we are having to see all these major layoffs because trade is diminishing with China and other trade partners. We're going to have to stimulate the way the U.S. has. We're going to have to stimulate the economy the way the Japanese have. We're going to print more of our currency. And guess what that gets us into, Kevin? It gets us into an inflationary downward spiral.
Right.
But the problem is we are, in fact, facing a deflationary cause to what in the end ends up being an inflationary downward spiral, because central bankers only know how to address deflation one way.
That's the only way. Look at Germany back in the early 1920s. It's the same thing. You address a deflationary cause with an inflationary printing, and then it turns into hyperinflation. Gosh, it's not rocket science.
Yeah, so central bank activism, what we've had here in the United States with the Fed, money printing, quantitative easing, asset purchases, all of this, and it's been duplicated in other parts of the world, it's at odds with organic growth to the degree that it promotes consumption and spending, not on the basis of income growth, not on the basis of job creation, but via additional debt,
mm-hmm.
which is it's ultimately as smothering as a wet blanket to fire. I mean, the world central bankers, they've papered over the problems of 2005 to 2008. A debt problem at its core was addressed by adding more debt. And it's no surprise that two of the three canaries in the coal mine are now singing. The Australian dollar weakness, Canadian dollar weakness.
Well, then copper.
Yeah, that's the last support. Watch copper. If we're trading at 350, 330, great. We need to be heading towards $4 a pound. And if we're not heading towards $4 a pound, then what Dr. Copper is telling you is that we're getting ready to go towards another round of deflation. Now, what is the trigger for that? Maybe it is this China Credit Trust Company and the year of the horse, the getting kicked in the teeth by the horse, and it being, again, not a trigger in the U.S. real estate market, what we had circa 2008, but maybe a trigger in someone else's market, but with the reverberations coming back and impacting not only U.S. housing, but ultimately our ability to finance our own deficits inexpensively. All of these things are interconnected.
Well, and it seems like we should continue to encourage maintaining liquidity and maintaining caution, because if you just look at the news right now, it seems that there's growth. You have to be looking, like you said, at these canaries. You think about the coal mine, okay? You're down there, you're doing your work, it's just one day, let's say it's sometime in the middle of the week, everything's just running together, you've got thoughts of your family. You look over to the side and you see a dead canary.
It tells you something's wrong. You need to get out. There's more gas in there than will support your life system. And
David,
guess what?
But you're busy. You've got other things on your mind. Okay, so it's a dead canary. There's two other canaries. They're still chirping.
Right.
Okay, but what you're saying is there's three canaries right now that are sort of tipping something off right now. And the tip-off is you need to get out of the mine.
Well, see, interesting conversation I had this week. A client quite reasonably asked, why not add an exposure to productive commodities, you know, specifically asking about an oil company, as opposed to just defensive commodities like gold and silver. Yeah, my colleague Dave Burgess pointed out that in the case of your major oil producers, yeah, you've had price appreciation, which has been attractive over the last 2 or 3 years, but the means by which virtually all oil producers have accomplished this has been unnatural and unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
Shell as an example. You look at the last 5 to 7 years, they've reduced the number of shares outstanding by 10 to 15%. So that helps them. We've talked about this ad nauseum for the last month or two.
Sure, boosts the earnings per share.
Yep.
It makes things look better than they are.
Meanwhile, that company has gone from $37 billion in debt to over $70 billion in debt. And you think to yourself, well, gracious, you know, oil's selling at 10 times what it was a decade ago. They've got to be making money hand over fist. Why are they leveraging up? Why are they, in essence, destroying their balance sheet, making themselves much more cyclically sensitive and vulnerable when it comes to supporting a $70 billion debt load?
Mm.
Why? And that's the realities. It doesn't matter what the price performance has been. You have to look at the income statements. You have to look at the balance sheets. And that's where the real story is told. You want to talk about a canary? There is all kinds of warning signs that we've got too much leverage in the financial system, not only amongst your financial institutions, but your general run-of-the-mill, you know, Dow 30, your blue chips.
Yeah, well, you know, I can't help but laugh, Dave. This is not laughing matter, but I'm just thinking about these canaries, and I'm thinking about, you know, for those Monty Python fans going back into the late 60s, 70s when they were filmed, you know, it was a weekly show in England. There's a skit in one of the Monty Pythons. It's one of my favorites. John Cleese goes in and buys a bird. Well, the bird immediately dies at the pet store, and he says, this parrot's dead. I need to bring the bird back. And he's like, oh, no, he's just merely sleeping. And the whole skit is someone trying to convince John Cleese that parrot is not dead. He's actually a live parrot. But what we have right now, we have signals, Dave, that have been consistent throughout the years that are telling us that we need to not take things at face value right now, but we need to prepare. What you're talking about with real estate. Okay, enjoy the fact that we may have a good real estate year because the Federal Reserve is committed to keeping rates low. But gosh, if you've got too much real estate on the books, you better lighten the load because this is not something that's going to last.
Well, where is the organic growth coming from? You know,
yeah.
Whether it's a Shell oil company, which, again, for many of these publicly traded companies, the companies are becoming a shell as they're taking out the value and compensating their top employees. Meanwhile, the long-term shareholder value is being destroyed.
Right.
You know, you look at that kind of activity and realize, wait a minute, price is one thing, value is another. What you're not getting is real long-term shareholder value, but you are getting a decent price today. I say you take the decent price and run.
Right.
And the same with a second home, a third home, a fourth home. If you have an overexposure to real estate, yes, you should have 25% of your assets in real estate. We're not saying go to zero, but for someone who has 50, 60, 70, 80, 90% of their assets in real estate, just understand that interest rates and demographics are the drivers. And if you don't have the equivalent of a baby boom in your neighborhood, in your town, in your state, in your country, guess what you are solely dependent on? You're dependent on financing, and that is interest rates in the variable of value creation. Are you going to see an increase in price on the basis of lower interest rates? Or are you going to see a decrease in price on the basis of higher interest rates? Coming out of 2013, going into 2014, I think the dangerous thing to assume is that we have a good information feed. The market gives us an indication of value, and that indication is price and price discovery.
Right.
And yet we've had the Fed the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, with a larger footprint in the marketplace than they have ever had before in terms of influencing prices.
It messes up price discovery. How do you really know the real price of anything when they're just printing money?
And how can you determine the real risk of any asset when the price is skewed, when it is messed up, when it is disturbed by this massive influx of capital, creation of debt, creation of money, whatever it may be in these various markets around the world?
Well, David, you were talking about messing up the blood of the pricing. You know, you think about people who get blood transfusions, sometimes other organs. Now, the system can either accept or reject the organ. If it accepts it, it still has an impact on the system. You know, I think of blood transfusions. I was reading an article the other night that said, yeah, red blood cells don't necessarily carry a nucleus with a new genetic code coming into the acceptor from the donor. But actually, there's enough white blood cells in there that you can still see traces of the other donor for a year and a half or more. And, you know, they still haven't figured out exactly how that affects the genetic code. But you've got the same type of thing coming in. You've got bad pricing coming into the market right now, and it's affecting everything. The long-term ramification, you know, Bible talks about unequal weights and measures, and an unequal weight and measure has long-term consequences.
And that is just, again, the skewing of price, the mispricing of a particular asset. This is very disturbing to me, thinking about the number of people we encounter who look at the equity markets today and say, it's where it should be. It's actually a fairly reasonable price. I think we should buy it here. And now, why not own real estate? It makes all the sense in the world. Look at price appreciation. It's doing quite well. No argument.
Right.
No argument. It has done well. It will continue to do well. This should be a great year for real estate. I want to know what's driving the price over the next 3, 5, 7 years, because frankly, you're talking about a totally illiquid asset. You better know where your liquidity is coming from. You bought it today. What is tomorrow? Is it tomorrow as in next Tuesday? Is it tomorrow as in 3 years from now? If you're assuming that you've got liquidity and you're going to get the price you want, you may be assuming more than you should be about, frankly, all of these markets. The stock market, yes, we think it's overpriced. As Andrew Smithers said, 50 to 75% overpriced at this point. The bond market, even Bill Gross would say, gosh, interest rate trends, they're turning and going the other direction. The cost of capital, interest rates, they're going higher. Bond prices are going lower. Prepare accordingly. Real estate behaves the same way as bonds do because they are an interest rate sensitive asset. And so to assume that we can see growth for the next 3, 5, 7, 10, 15 years, you're putting together a real estate portfolio. Just understand, your income may be secure, but guess what's not secure? The value of the asset itself. And by the way, how are those assets repriced when, in terms of income relative to money market, you are now unattractive? In other words, you may lock in a 5% rate of return on a real estate project today, but what happens when your tax-free bond is paying 6%? Or your treasury bill or bank deposit is paying 7.5%. All of a sudden, you look and say, why would I buy real estate that's illiquid for 5.5%? Guess what happens to the value of the property? It's discounted accordingly until it reflects the market rate. This is the problem, Kevin. The market rates have been destroyed by central bankers.
Well, one of the ways that you can actually recapture the consequence, because the consequence will be things snapping back to their correct levels. That's what history tells us. And so you step aside, you put it into gold. Now, I'm not saying everything, but you make sure that you have enough gold, cash, liquidity, that you can come back in and buy that repricing.
You have to allow markets to do what they always do, which is snap back to reality and not be sort of propped up artificially. This is not reality. It's not that we're uninterested in real estate. It's not that we're uninterested in equities. It's not that we're uninterested in bonds. In fact, I prefer all of those assets.
They're just the wrong price right now.
They're the wrong price. So what do you do in the interim? Leave your money to be managed by Janet Yellen and Ben Bernanke and 600 PhDs who have accomplished one thing in 100 years, diminished the purchasing power of your dollar by 96%? How's that for a pedigree? I don't care about the pedigree. I don't care about the PhD. Show me results. They've failed. That's where you want to put your money. We're left with very few options. And we are in an interim period, a transitional period, where economic realities still have to play out. And as they play out, then you return to what every investor needs to make a wise decision: accurate pricing, true price discovery. When you have accurate pricing, true price discovery, you know what risk is, you know what reward is, and you know how and when to place your assets.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. mcalvany.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvany Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvany Weekly Commentary.